Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Alifair Burke. She joins us by telephone from, where are you, Portland?
I'm in Portland, Oregon right now. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You've got this new book out, Never Tell, and it gave us an excuse to call you up. Are you out there working on another book?
I am. I'm kind of holed up here. I've been here for 2 weeks, and I've got two more weeks, and I'm hoping to get the next book all wrapped up by the end of summer.
Well, Portland, isn't that kind of your old stomping ground? Didn't you go to Reed?
I went to Reed College, and then I worked here as a lawyer, as a prosecutor, after I finished law school for about 5 years. I've been in New York for about 10 years, but I come back here every summer. Summer is definitely the time of year to be in Portland.
Oh, so you're really comfortable out there. It's a good place to write.
Great place.
This new one, Never Tell, is set in New York City. You've got your NYPD Detective Ellie Hatcher on the case, and this is a very complex story. How did you come up with this one?
Well, I wanted the next book that I wrote to be something that was very much about Ellie Hatcher. This is the fourth book in the Ellie Hatcher series, and the book that I wrote last year, Long Gone, was a standalone, so I'd really kind of been away from Ellie Hatcher as a character for over a year. And sort of in the year that I was writing Long Gone, every once in a while, you know, Ellie Hatcher would pop up in my head saying, she should do this, she should do that. Like, you go away, you know, I'll talk to you next year. So when I was getting back to the series, I really wanted it to be a case where Ellie wasn't merely an investigator. I wanted it to be very much about her. And so I started thinking about what might that be, and she's had people come after her before in very personal ways. I'm like, well, you know, let's not do that again. So instead, it's a story about a high school student, Julia Whitmire, whose body is found in the bathtub of her family's townhouse. And everybody thinks it looks like a suicide, including Ellie. But her parents insist that it's not. They just can't accept the fact that their daughter, who they thought had a wonderful life, would have ended it all on her own. So Ellie resists this, and she thinks the family needs to just accept it. And she comes to realize, though, that she starts to question her own judgment because her own father died under mysterious terms. Her own father, she never really was able to accept whether he committed suicide or whether he was a murder victim. And so for the first time in the course of the series, Ellie is actually questioning her own judgment, which is something normally if she makes a mistake, it's because she thinks she's the smartest person in the room. But the story about a family that really can't accept their daughter's death was something that's very personal to her. So I thought that that was the right kind of case. And then from there, of course, there's all kinds of other components to it. But it began with that.
And this young woman has been attending a very exclusive New York City day school, prep school. And this is a big element in the story, too, isn't it?
Yeah, so that was kind of the second piece of where the idea came from. I'm a law professor now, and I've been doing that, I guess, for 12 years now. And it's even in that short period of time, I've seen a change in my students that's, I think, very much a part of their generation and very much a mark of these times, that they're under incredible pressure to succeed. And ironically, sometimes the pressure to succeed is actually higher among the kids that already have it, right? You'd think it was the kids who are the first to go to college and, you know, are taking out all of their tuition on loans, that they would be the ones pulling their hair out. But as hard as they work, sometimes because they came from nothing, they have some perspective about, you know, I'm on the right path, I'm going to do better than my last generation of my family and that kind of thing. It's actually sometimes the most elite kids who've always had everything handed to them, that no matter whether they succeed or not, are going to always be wealthy, they're going to always be powerful, that they get lost. And it's a weird kind of pressure that, because there's no pressure on them, what does their life even mean? You know, what are they doing? What are they supposed to do with themselves? And so this piece peek into this very elite world that I didn't even know existed until I lived in Manhattan. These kids that by the time they're in junior high school, they already, you know, are supposed to have, you know, their hands on all the wheels and are supposed to already be becoming power brokers and already have drivers driving them around, and they go to clubs when they're in high school and nobody seems to care whether they're of legal age or not.
Mm-hmm.
That little peek into that world. So Julia Whitmire comes from the elite day school. I used a fake school, of course, but
uh-huh.
It could have been based on one of a few in Manhattan. And so this kind of peek into Julia's world and her kind of surprising cast of characters. I mean, some of her friends are more like her who are from the Kasdan prep school, but she's also, because she kind of yearns for, she wants to think she's kind of wild and she wants to think she's rebellious. She's also hanging around with homeless kids in Washington Square Park, so she's kind of straddling two very different worlds, and Ellie's investigation into her death brings her into those worlds.
Allifair Burke joins us. Her new novel is Never Tell. And this this jockeying for position, again, in these exclusive schools in Manhattan, it really begins in kindergarten and before, doesn't it? And there's so much pressure, and these places don't want even a hint of scandal. And in your imaginary prep school, there are some things that are scandalous going on. We read the New York Times, and we see that these exclusive schools have these scandals. They don't want anybody to know about them. There was an article in the Times a while back about these kids under pressure to get the good grades and to do well in tests were taking prescription drugs they weren't supposed to be taking. That's just one element, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's funny. When I first got the idea for the book, it was actually a couple of years ago, one of my students told me that, or a student told me that by his estimate, probably half of my law students take Ritalin and other drugs that they really aren't supposed to be taking during finals to get an edge, to help them concentrate, just simply to help focus. And the idea that you would do something like that, to take what can be a very dangerous drug if it's not supposed to be in your body, to just get a little bit of an edge to help you concentrate, I think I found that absolutely fascinating, and I had never heard anything like that before. And of course, by the time the book was finished and getting set for publication, it was on the front page of the New York Times about how common this is. And then also in terms of, you know, the educators who should be the people who are trying to stop this, that instead they think about the reputation of the school. One of the, you know, so-called better schools in the New York area currently, it's almost like something out of Penn State or something out mm-hmm. of the church, that these cover-ups that apparently have been going on for years and years and years about teachers abusing the kids, and instead of doing anything about it, they just didn't want the reputation of the school tarnished. So when Julia dies and it turns out that she's been using some drugs she shouldn't have been taking, and then there's some other scandals going on at the school, the headmaster at Kasdan, rather than helping Ellie try to figure out what happened, instead she starts admonishing the students that they better not talk to the media and they better pull down their Facebook accounts, and that they don't want word of this to get out.
And of course, you take us down a little road where we meet one of the teachers who's very handsome and charismatic, and we immediately think, oh, it was him.
Right. Well, that's, you know, part of the fun of a mystery novel and a thriller is, as much as I kind of use them to explore social issues that I find timely and current and interesting and all of that, you want it to be a page turner, right? So
mm-hmm.
Part of the fun of the genre that I choose to write in is, you know, you get to try to trick readers, and you've always got to have somebody on the page who seems like, oh, that's obviously going to be the person.
Uh-huh.
And so, that, you know, the novices to the genre might fall for that, but then the experts will be like, oh, I know what Burke is up to. That guy's the red herring, and so they'll think it's somebody else, but it's never that guy either, at least not in my books.
And you have this wonderful currency. You just talked about the fact that you heard a few years ago about these drugs being used to apparently attempt to enhance the ability to study for tests or whatever, And here it's been front page news long after you wrote the book. Suddenly we're reading about it in the New York Times. You've got all these really current buzz kind of things going on. You've got the blogger who's writing a blog about how she was sexually abused. You've got a young person with gender issues. You've got all these things rolled in here. How do you decide, okay, this will work? How do I get this into my story?
It's funny. It kind of creeps in. It's, I can spend all day just looking around the world, and I'm always people watching, and I'm always reading the paper, and I'm always reading magazine articles, and I love watching our culture change. I mean, if I could live forever, it wouldn't be for my own personal experiences. It would be to find out what happens. Like, it's an amazing world that we live in that changes so fast. And so I'm always keeping track of things like that. And I don't sit down and say, okay, I want the book to feel timely, and I just read about this thing, and that'll be interesting, so let's throw that in there. It's really more that when I am hearing from a student about how kids are starting to take these A to D meds for just study purposes, that I start thinking about how that could become a very even more nefarious thing, or how that could be misused, or and so I start thinking about that, and it kind of creeps its way into the novel. You mentioned Casey Hines, who's a transgender girl living in kind of in a shelter, but she's essentially homeless. But that character is somebody I've been thinking about for years, and she never actually was never clear where she fit into a book, but it was somebody I always thought about. And then when I started thinking about who Julia Whitmire was, because she's not sort of I don't think that she's somebody who is typical of, if you were to sit down and write the prototypical kind of prep school student. You know, her dad is a rock producer, and her mother used to be a designer, and so she's kind of, all of her friends live up on the Upper East Side where the school's located, but they're down in Greenwich Village, and you know, so she wants to think of herself as a little funkier. And so I started thinking about, you know, what would her world really look like, and that's when this character I'd been carrying around, Casey, really fit in. I'm like, you know, that character I've been thinking of would really be somebody that would like Ramona, would like Julia, and Julia would like Casey. And the funny thing is, when I came up with that character, it was 19, it was probably the first time you and I talked. No, it would have been like 2004 or something like that. I thought about putting Casey in a book that was set in Portland, so it would have been my third book. So maybe 2005, I had this idea about Casey, and I had talked to a couple people about it, and they were like, you know, it's too weird, and people won't like it, and it wasn't a reason not to use the character. It was more that character wound up not fitting into the book I was working on at the time. So when I did it, when I decided to have Casey be a big part of Nevertell, I didn't say anything to my publisher or my agent or my editor, because I didn't want to hear that conversation again about, oh, this is unacceptable, you can't do this. I'm like, you know, I'll put Casey in the book and we'll see what happens. So if there's pushback, I'll deal with it. Nobody ever said anything. I mean, and that's what I mean by how fast our world changes. That I haven't gotten a single letter of complaint, you know, telling me that Casey's an abomination. I haven't gotten anything like that. And if anything, people have been like, what a wonderful character. You know, this is somebody I haven't seen before on the page. And I marvel at that, I guess. That wasn't, you know, 8 years that people have changed that much.
It is amazing. Alifair Burke joins us, and this title is so perfect, Never Tell, because as we go through, we see how it fits so many things that are going on in the story right up to the very end. And the thing that really tickled me is, as we're trying to figure out, did this girl kill herself, or was she murdered? And if she was murdered, who did it? You develop this amazingly complex trajectory where we eventually come to an even more interesting homicide. And, oh, man, I mean, we really want to know what happened to this young woman. But when we get to this next one, this is so hot and juicy. I mean, oh.
I know, and thank you for not saying what it is, because it was such a spoiler. It's funny because, you know, the jacket copy is, of course, the if it's a suicide or not story of Julia Whitmire, but that's really the launching pad. You know, it kind of sounds almost like a familiar thing you may have read before, but it's really the launching pad for Ellie realizing that the case she's working, you know, the girl in the bathtub, is really the culmination of 15 years of events and 15 years of secrets that really involve multiple families. And Julia's death is sort of one tragic outcome of all of these secrets. So Never Tell, of course, refers to all of those secrets, but part of the big, what I think is suspenseful about the book isn't just the traditional whodunit aspect of a mystery, but while Ellie is learning the facts about Julia Whitmire, as you mentioned, the reader is also learning that there is a woman who's been blogging about her sexual abuse of a child and how she recovered from that, you know, 15 years earlier in a different place, that has nothing to do with Julia Whitmire, and she starts getting threatened online. And so part of the mystery, of course, is what do these two people have to do with each other? And I think the outcome, the answer to that, I think, is surprising, but I think it also, the title for me, Never Tell, really refers to the damage that was done because the author, the mysterious author of the blog, when she was abused, could never tell. Right? Mm. She was told never tell, that her mother wouldn't let her tell and didn't believe her, and the destruction that winds up happening because of the sexual abuse and the fact that the girl couldn't talk about it, and everything that unfolds from that, that it winds up affecting Julia Whitmire. That, for me, was sort of the big puzzle part of the book, is juggling all of that to take 15 years of secrets and have it look like, you know, the death of one girl in New York, when, of course, it's about much more.
Well, we have a lot of crime fiction on this program, and when it comes to your book, I have learned that the title also applies to me. Never tell the spoilers.
I've grown up reading the genre, and I really do love it. You know, people refer to them as beach books, or, you know, their guilty pleasure, and that's fine, you know, but I hope people do have some respect for the genre, because the best books have the good writing and the memorable characters and a sense of place and all the things you like about your good, weighty literature. But I really respect, but maybe it's because I like puzzles, or I like that aspect, but I really like a well-constructed mystery where when you get to the end and you find out all the answers, it was something that you never figured out, but it shouldn't come out of nowhere. It has to be one of those things where you say, it was all there. It was all there. Why didn't I see that? And I love it when I read a book like that. So that's always my goal, is to have it be a surprise, but have it be a fair game. You know, it can't be totally out of left field.
Alifair Burke joins us. According to the press materials your publicist sent me, you've been praised by your peers, all of whom coincidentally have been on this program: Michael Connelly, Harlan Coben, Laura Lippman, Tammy Hoag. Now, did I detect a slight homage to Michael Connelly, unnamed, in your book? Did I pick up on that?
You know, somebody said that to me, and it's certainly possible. And will you remind me what it was?
Apparently, one of your characters likes reading crime fiction with a Lincoln Continental on the cover of the book.
Yes.
Okay.
I always leave little, thank you, but isn't it terrible? I'm in the middle of writing it. You know, I'm almost done with my next book, so it was a while since I wrote Never Tell. So I think in every book there's some little nugget. There's some little gift for people who read the genre where it's a little inside joke, and I'm certainly not the only writer who does that. I think Michael Connelly, in fact, has had references to my dad's character, Dave Robichaux, and I think he's also had Elvis Cole sightings. In this book, the police go and look at somebody's apartment as part of their investigation, and Ellie's partner, or Ellie pulls a paperback book out from under the bed, and it's about a lawyer who works out of his, or the cover, she says the cover has a Lincoln Continental on it, and she says she recognizes it as a series of books that J.J. Rogan, her partner, is always praising. So that was a Connolly reference.
Well, it's really amazing that you just mentioned your dad, James Lee Burke, and you just mentioned Elvis Cole, because by a weird coincidence, Robert Kraes and your dad have been on this show more than anybody else.
Is that right? Yep, well, you clearly have excellent taste, yeah. And so does Michael Connolly.
Your dad is number one, Bob is number two, and I know from talking to your dad that you have a connection. There's a nugget connecting you to Ellie, because Ellie grew up in Kansas, and when you were a little girl, weren't you living in Kansas when the serial killer was operating?
Thank my parents for that one. That's one of the things about being a little kid, is you don't get to decide where you live. So when we were, I guess I would have been seven, my parents decided to move from southern Florida, because they thought it was too chaotic, and, you know, they wanted a better life for me and all these things. So they moved to Wichita, Kansas, we were still unpacking the moving boxes when the local news finally announced that there had been a serial killer killing people over the course of, I think by that time it had been a few years, and they had never told the public that these killings were connected. And I'm looking at my parents like, thanks a lot. Not only do I not have the beach anymore, I got a serial killer in town. But the strange thing, not to make light of it, it's very hard to describe the atmosphere in Wichita during those years, because there was this odd juxtaposition between the things you would read in the newspaper that were just incredibly twisted. I mean, the guy called himself BTK, which stood for bind, torture, and kill.
Mm-hmm.
So you're hearing that when you're 7, 8 years old. The facts of it, which included entire families and children, literally tortured. And knowing he was out there, and the police having no idea who it was, and not having told people that this guy was out there for, you know, a period of years. And if you were to take a map and map out all the places that he had killed people, our house was really kind of in the middle of that.
Oh, no.
And yet, at the same time, the complacency. It was sort of everybody almost sort of accepted he was out there. It wasn't like, if that happened in Portland, Oregon, or in New York City, I mean, we all know what happened in New York City, right? People were yelling and screaming for them to catch Son of Sam until they caught him. You know, it was an anger, and not just at the killer, but an anger at the people who hadn't caught him. And in Wichita, it was just sort of like, well, I assume, like, this is just normal, and this happens everywhere, and they'll get to it. I mean, it was an odd kind of thing. But you'd come home, and it was how everybody lived there. Everybody had locks on their basement doors. To this day, like, if I live in a house with a basement, like, we all still lock our basement doors, because it was just habit. Because they thought, falsely at the time, but they thought that he got entry into the basement and then came in through the basement. So everybody bolted their basement doors, and you would check the phone. As soon as you got it home, you were supposed to check the phone to make sure that there was a dial tone, because he would cut the phone cords when he attacked people. So, you know, it's an odd way to grow up, that you're thinking about that. And I do think very much that affected my interest in crime and made me start reading mysteries. I started reading mystery novels as a little kid, and I think I liked the idea that in those books there's always a solution, right? That there's all this chaos and darkness in the book, but at the end, you know, there's a resolution to that. I really do think that that's why I went to those books over and over and over again. You know, my mom would take me to the library every week, and she was just like, I cannot find age-appropriate mysteries. I'm running out, you know.
Ella Fair Burke joins us, her new novel, Never Tell. And I know that you're tired of people asking you this, but I just had your dad on the program, and he says, oh, she'll never talk about herself, but she's just the greatest. She's the most wonderful, you know, your dad. I mean, the way he praises you is just amazing. He thinks so much of you. And then we have these Dave Robichaux books and the character, Dave's daughter, Alla Fair, who is a graduate of Stanford Law in the new book. She's written her first novel. Dave's mother's name was Alla Fair, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What's the deal? I mean, you know, I know you've got a pat answer to this, but let's go a little deeper in the just a minute or two that we have left.
Sure.
How do you feel about it? Do you laugh? Are you tickled? How do you feel?
Sure. I mean, it's I'm tickled and flattered, of course, that at first it really wasn't me, to tell you the truth. It was the shared name. I'm named after my dad's great-grandmother, Dave Robichaux's mother was also named Alla Fair, so in a weird way, Alla Fair Robichaux and I were really just named for the same woman. But as he was writing the character, she started to take on more of my attributes, and so, you know, she's sort of a very fictionalized me. You know, she's 20 years younger, though, and she grew up in the Bayou, which is not where I grew up, and so she's really not me, but she's a fictional me. I like it. You know, when I read it, I think it's very sweet that he's done that. I think it shows how much, you know, as a father, he's kind of writing from that experience. And so then I'll find little things where things from her childhood are things that we did together and things we would say to each other. And, I mean, that means the world to me. In terms of people thinking that I was rescued off of an airplane or any of that kind of stuff, you know, I just have to explain, like, no, that part's fiction, you know. So, but like any book, you know, things that happen in real life become fictionalized, and you just can't look too hard into it, or it, you know, otherwise everybody I know would be reading my books wondering where they are in it and what I'm trying to say about them, or if it's a reflection about them. And nothing I write is about anybody I know, not like that, you know. So I don't take it as a message to me or that it's me, or I hope she doesn't die at any point, because I don't know if you've noticed, but if you hang around Dave Robichaux, it's not the safest thing in the world.
Right.
So, if he ever killed her, I might have problems with that, but otherwise I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, Alla Fair, it's really been a treat having you on the program.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun. I appreciate it.
Our guest has been Alla Fair Burke. Her new book is Never Tell. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week when our guest will be Nora Vincent. She returns to the program with her first novel. It's a very unusual story called Thy Neighbor. Nora Vincent in the Book Nook, right here on your public radio station, WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.